It's the Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting with Jenny Finch and a team of top writing talent.
This month's book is The Book of Joy, which is a record of 7 days spent in the company of two Nobel laureates, Archbishop Desmond Tutu and Tenzin Gyatso, the 14th Dalai Lama. The meeting was arranged to celebrate the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday, and although seriously ill, Archbishop Tutu flew to Dharamsala to be with his friend. The writer, Douglas Abrams, acted as translator and scribe as the two men, both great spiritual leaders to the world, discussed joy, that elusive, fleeting emotion that seems in such short supply at the present. He saw himself as the people's ambassador, posing questions from citizens across the world and weaving the answers into a coherent manuscript.
The Dalai Lama's audience room had been transformed into a dining room. At the far end was an ornate golden Buddha, encased in a colourful wooden box. The walls were hung with thangas, brightly painted silk scrolls that depicted images of the Buddha and other Buddhist figures. They were traditionally hung on the walls of monasteries for brief periods of time to inspire meditative practice. They were used to encourage practitioners along the path of enlightenment. The windows were covered with white lace curtains, and the table was set for lunch, with baskets of Tibetan flatbread and boxed juice containers. The whole setting was simple, almost like a picnic, and the meal was typical Tibetan food from the Dalai Lama's kitchen. There were noodles and vegetables and momos, the famed Tibetan steamed dumplings. The Dalai Lama and Archbishop Tutu sat across from each other. As I sat next to the Dalai Lama, I could feel in his posture and his body language the power of a leader. I remembered how strongly and tenderly he had held my hands the first time we met. His kindness did not in any way diminish his power, a valuable reminder that compassion is a feature of strength, not weakness, a point they would make throughout our conversations. When the Dalai Lama greets you, he takes your hand and then rubs it tenderly as a grandparent might. He looks into your eyes, feels deeply what you are feeling, and touches his forehead to yours. Whatever feeling, elation, or anguish is in your heart and reflected on your face, it is mirrored in his. But then, when he meets the next person, those emotions are gone, and he is wholly available for the next encounter and the next moment. Perhaps that is what it means to be fully present, available for each moment and each person we encounter, untethered by the ruminating memories of the past, and are not lured by the anticipatory worry of the future. The lunch began by returning to the theme of birthdays, aging and mortality. I went to see a German specialist for knees, the Dalai Lama said. He found my physical condition very good, and then he told me my knees were the problem. He said you are not 18 years old, but 80 years old, so nothing much can be done. I really felt that was a great teaching. It is very important to think about impermanence. He reminds me, I'm 80 years old. That's wonderful. But, my friend, you are even older than me. Are you showing off? The Archbishop said. My own kitchen made this, the Dalai Lama said, as he offered a piece of bread to his honoured guest.
The book has three main angles. The two men's teaching about joy itself, an examination of current and recent science in relation to happiness, and sections on the week itself. One of the main pillars of their teaching is the internal source of joy and its obstacles, fear, loneliness, and grief, amongst others. It is our personal reaction to these obstacles that can give them their power over our emotions and prevents us experiencing joy. They identify fear as the root of all the other negative emotions and offer a series of steps to overcome it, building a path to happiness and ultimately joy. Much of this sounds closer to Buddhist doctrine than Christianity, but the book is not rooted in any one religion. The eight pillars of joy consist of universal values: humility, forgiveness, acceptance, and compassion, for example, are part of the canon of all the major religions and are held by people of none. But this is much more than a book of theory. Both men acknowledge how difficult it can be to view life as a source of joy, both on an everyday level and faced with the huge global problems and conflicts that surround us. The path to joy, they say, is through connection with others rather than focusing on ourselves. This can bring about a sense of perspective. Our troubles are less, we are less fearful and stressed, and can reach out to aid another if needed.
I think the majority of people everywhere believe that bloodshed is not good and have a desire for peace. Around the time of my meeting with the Queen Mother, I also had a conversation with the renowned quantum physicist Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker, who was the brother of the then West German president. Von Weizsäcker too argued that the world was improving. For example, he said that in the past, every German felt that the French were his enemy and every French felt the Germans were his enemy. Now these archenemies have joined together and have formed the Franco-German unified force. They have also been key players in the formation of the European Union. It is not perfect, but it is progress. So then, eventually, the Berlin Wall disappeared. Not by force, but by popular movement. So you see, change. Now, China is also changing. Cuba is also changing. North Korea alone, perhaps, has not changed yet. So these things are positive signs. Human beings, through wider contact and more education, are becoming more mature. It takes time, and we must take the long view. When we look at our world with a longer time frame, say of 100 years, we can then envisage a world that is very different, a better, kinder, a more equitable, more joyful world. But we must start the process of that change now, not wait for some ideal time. The ideal time is now. The Dalai Lama was arguing for this longer perspective, and I could not help but think of Sir Martin Rees's comment that we were only halfway through our evolution as a species on this planet. When one thinks of the long parade of the human journey, it is really quite extraordinary to think what we can become in a century, in a millennium or more. After meeting with so many people, thinkers, scientists, educators, healthcare professionals, social workers and activists, the Dalai Lama continued, it is clear that the only way to truly change our world is through teaching compassion. Our society is lacking an adequate sense of compassion, sense of kindness, and genuine regard for others' well-being. So now many, many people who seriously think about humanity all have the same view. He was pointing both his index fingers at his temple to emphasize the logic of their conclusion. We must promote basic human values, the inner values that lie at the heart of who we are as humans. Religion is not sufficient. Religion has been very important in human history, and perhaps for another 1,000 years it will continue to bring benefits to humanity. The Dalai Lama knew he was being controversial, calling the long-term value of religion into question, and he had taken the Archbishop's hands to comfort him and reaffirm that he was not planning to put either of them out of a job anytime soon. So now we have to think seriously. Just to pray or rely on religious faith is not sufficient. It will remain a source of inspiration. But in terms of 7 billion human beings, it's not sufficient. No matter how excellent, no religion can be universal. So we have to find another way to promote these values. I think the only way really is, as we have said, through education. Education is universal. We must teach people, especially our youth, the source of happiness and satisfaction. We must teach them that the ultimate source of happiness is within themselves. Not machine, not technology, not money, not power. We are not talking about heaven or hell or Buddhahood or salvation. These are too far away, he laughed. So our book is part of this important process to help spread the message that love, kindness, and affection are the source of joy and happiness. As you already made clear, our basic human nature is good, is positive. So that can give us a basis for courage and self-confidence. So that's why we spend a lot of time discussing all of this. There must be some real concrete purpose and result, or if not, it's better to sleep. The Dalai Lama pretended to lean over on his elbow toward the Archbishop as if falling asleep, and then laughed. I turned to Archbishop Tutu and said, "I'd like to invite you, Archbishop, to address your readers directly and offer them a blessing." He turned to the camera and began to speak. "Dear child of God, you are loved with a love that nothing can shake, a love that loved you long before you were created, a love that will be there long after everything has disappeared. You are precious, with a preciousness that is totally quite immeasurable. And God wants you to be like God, filled with life and goodness and laughter and joy."
The final section of the book covers a series of simple practices to help develop the reader's ability to overcome the obstacles to joy in their own lives. They combine both well-established spiritual practices with some of the more scientific knowledge on the benefits of reflection and contemplation. Taken from both spiritual paths, these simple exercises are designed to help restore a sense of balance and to reduce fear and stress. One of the great delights of this book is the use of personal stories by both men to illustrate their ideas. They're quite happy to use their own weaknesses and failings to make a point and to laugh at their foibles and mistakes. Abraham's record of their friendship is one of the highlights of this book, showing them as human beings as well as great spiritual leaders. This, together with the film that resulted from their meeting, helps lift the book into an unforgettable and inspirational text that has given help, guidance, and comfort to millions of readers since his publication.
And if you were to take the thoughts of His Holiness the Dalai Lama and, of course, the late African Bishop, Archbishop Desmond Tutu to the fore, you'd say that actually when you're going through the agony that a Middlesbrough supporter is going through at present, you need the Book of Joy. But what say you, Rob?
Yeah, very, very true indeed, yes. Yeah, it's a good sense of perspective reading that book, accompanying as Middlesbrough season peters out, rather.
Yeah, of course, but who knows, with the remaining games, they could actually all turn it around. But let's start to talk football at this particular moment, because as you do say, it does put things into perspective when we see, obviously, the Chinese oppression of the Tibetan people, the exile of, obviously, the Dalai Lama, and, of course, Archbishop Tutu and his experiences with apartheid, South Africa, and so on. So a lot of those things are very much at the heart of this book. But what did you make of the text as you've waded your way through it?
It is a joyful read, isn't it? And particularly at the times that we see at the moment, with war, global warming, pandemic, etc. It's a real antidote and a formula for perhaps going forward with your life. From two people that, in many respects, as you just sort of outlined, they've got a lot of reasons to be bitter, haven't they, from their experiences. And they've also seen an awful lot of strife to people around them and people they represent. But yet they've come to a different conclusion. But it's not something where you could be very dismissive, and it's interesting. There's a third author involved who can constantly question them. He can talk to them and say, "Well, it's all right for you. You're sort of protected from many of the pressures of everyday life." But they answer all those sort of questions. They put things in a way that can be relatable for anybody. It's sort of a way that you can sort of find a sort of peace and joy in your life, even in times of going through, personal battles and bigger battles, as we see quite literally in Ukraine.
Leadership is something which human beings have been both the victims and the benefactors of over the last few millennia. And I think one of the interesting points is the Dalai Lama's suggestion that actually religion itself over the next 1,000 years may well actually lose its focus. But at the present time in our history, shall we say, with many world leaders not necessarily living up to expectations, whatever those expectations might be, whether you happen to be Vladimir Putin, whether you happen to be Joe Biden, Boris Johnson, name the country in many ways. You've got a whole range of challenges within that. Do you feel it's interesting that here we have two clear religious leaders who are at least espousing a philosophy that whatever your particular beliefs or non-beliefs or thoughts on the world, do as we approach the annual Mental Health Week in Britain, actually carries with them some weight in terms of how we cope with the challenges of life on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the fundamentals of both Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama is being all embracing and not putting up barriers. They will talk to anybody. They will cut across any sort of religion. They don't see religion as boundaries. They look for the common, don't they, between people, the common denominators between different peoples. They don't look for boundaries, which again is an amazing lesson, life lesson that they've learned, I suppose, from very well. I'm going to say they come from very different angles. They've got so many differences between them, and yet they find so much in common, and they obviously get on so well, and it allows them to meet together. And look at ways that can help anybody really, and help the world, in a particularly troubled century.
Since the book was obviously first published, Archbishop Desmond Tutu has, of course, passed and transcended, moved to another level, whatever beliefs happen to be within that. He did make one very pertinent point, which I was particularly struck by, insofar as he did say that Nelson Mandela actually learnt within his prison sentence that there was this commonality. And rather than being adversarial, sometimes you do need to embrace the sense of forgiveness. And actually, if you can embrace that, you're 95% of the way towards recovery.
Yeah, absolutely. He said that he went into there as a freedom fighter. And obviously, he's a freedom fighter legally, but also literally a freedom fighter, and he had his mistreatment was absolutely phenomenal, but he says that he found a sort of peace and reconciliation through that, and became a more powerful person, I suppose, in every respect. And of course there's so many lessons that we can draw from South Africa in the way that it didn't suddenly disappear into a terrible bloodbath civil war, which is what the white ruling element always feared and always used as kind of their defense. But it became like a rainbow nation, didn't it? It tried to take everybody together and to forgive, it was a very powerful success story, and absolutely, that it was really interesting to hear him say that about Nelson Mandela and that almost like that 20 odd years was it in captivity, that it actually had been some positives that for him and for the country that had been drawn from it.
And whilst we're looking for positives, difficult though is to actually find them. Whatever your political persuasion might be, the scenario currently faced globally within Ukraine, within the Russian-Ukraine conflict, within obviously the proposed suggestion, which many people quite rightly would find quite abhorrent, about shipping prospective refugees off to Rwanda before they actually can apply again to take part in Britain. Do you feel that there are, to use the cliche, lessons to be learned in terms of that, to acknowledge that no matter how much difficulty people are actually going through at present, we need to at least acknowledge that there is a common element to the whole human species and we need to embrace that and be prepared to forgive as well.
We do, and we need to react against nationalism, Alex. We need to stand up against it. We need to. It's just so divisive, and it always leads to conflict in one way or another. And they also mention, they talk about religion. They talk about, they say that religion itself is not the problem. It's the fanatics in religion that refuse to see any other sort of paths or embrace any other faiths or look for common goals. And it does give you some hope that there is another way. And you just hope that people that enough people can read a book like this, or enough people can get the simple messages, and to go against the trend that's happening around the world at the moment. I suppose it's, you know, we've said for some time that it's quite reminiscent of the 1930s, and when there are real problems in the world, people will look inward and will look and will put up barriers and will look for simple solutions of nationalism and things like that, and we've got to look outward. The pandemic should have taught us one thing, Alex, is that we're all in this together as a world, and it didn't matter who you were or where you were, there was no escape from it, and we've got to take that on board and sort of work together and stop all this divisiveness.
A message which certainly needs to be continually repeated, it would seem. Rob, it would be crass to actually ask you for your favourite characters in this, because clearly they're both real people, and even the narrator is a person for that. So I'm not going to do that, but I am going to ask you, what would your score be for the text, The Book of Joy?
Yeah, they're very much real people, and you know, there aren't many great people in the world and
we all have the potential to be great, but how do we actually achieve that greatness?
Yeah, well, I'm talking about I suppose you just mentioned at the start that the about leaders and false leaders, and we've got a strange election going on now in France, and but these two guys are worth listening to, or were listening to, worth listening to as leaders, and therefore it's so well put together. I've got to give it. And the messages that come out of it are so useful and so positive that I've got to give it a 9.
Well, we've just heard from Rob Nichols there, who's on his way to the joys of Swansea to obviously follow his agony with respect to Middlesbrough Football Club and so on and so forth. But we do have Jessica Burtis fresh from North Carolina with us. Jessica, hopefully an antidote to the stress caused by Ken Follett last month with Never. How did the Book of Joy connect with yourself?
Yeah, this is definitely a change of tone from last month. But, you know, I think that this book is so important. And maybe it's because I'm coming off like the back of Lent and Easter. But it's, I think, well, for one, it's remarkable, their friendship, because these are two very wise men who came together to write something for a world that I feel, especially nowadays, like people are more depressed and more lonely and more anxious than they seem to have been before. And I feel like society has kind of, in my own personal view, like I feel like society has kind of gotten hedonistic in a way where we kind of chase instant gratification, but people are still so unhappy, and I feel like there's not a lasting joy there. And I feel like this book, I love how it highlights that joy and pain are kind of related. Like, you need suffering to reach joy, and I feel like it's something where nowadays we often try and run from pain immediately. It's considered a very bad thing, and this book is kind of saying, like, you need to embrace it in a way and use that to turn towards others. I loved how they talk about how anger is poison, but the antidote is compassion and turning towards others, because I feel like whenever I'm angry, I think it's a very addictive emotion. And I think that, you know, especially nowadays, like social media, you know, I feel like it's so easy to jump on social media and get mad about something like immediately. At least that's a bad habit of mine. And I feel like it's so easy when we do live in such like kind of a removed social media digital age to kind of forget people and forget to be compassionate. And I think this book places a big emphasis on that and just remembering that everybody is human. Because we might say that a lot, we hear that a lot, oh, everybody's human, but I feel like it's not put into practice very much. So I feel like this book is a really good reminder to do that, especially, you know, with spring, like everything's coming back to life, the world's looking a bit more beautiful, a bit more hopeful. I feel like it's a great time to try and start using these strategies that they talk about.
Really insightful review there, I think, Jessica. And it's something which, certainly having just spoken with Rob, the fact that obviously Desmond Tutu is no longer with us, he passed away December last year, makes it even more poignant. I must admit, I was drawn almost to tears when the description of the young Tibetan children who effectively were trying to explain their stories. And it kind of also gives us that line that we might think we've got it tough in our particular life, either in North Carolina, Lincoln, Tipperary, any of those zones, etc. But in comparison, you know, to some of those sort of areas, really traumatic tales, but the way they actually were used to work through that. I mean, Jenny, you've got psychological training. Did you feel that there was a very good sense of therapy here? I mean, forget the notion of religions, forget the notion of the philosophy of that side of things, etc., and the Buddhist Christian beliefs and so on. Did you feel that actually there was a lot of rational thoughts in terms of, as Jessica's just been saying, not reacting immediately in a world that kind of almost encourages anger? I mean, Facebook makes its money from people being angry.
I agree, absolutely, yes. The science that they're using for to explore the way the brain reacts to happiness, to anger, to joy, to grief, is integrated very well into this book. And from a psychological point of view, this is an excellent textbook. It doesn't give you lots of religion. It doesn't give you lots of science. What it gives you are a series of steps that are both spiritual and scientifically and psychologically very sound. And the basis of it is reflection. And I found the bit most helpful was humility, that you stop and you look and you think, well, I wrote this book, hey, I'm a published author. And then you think of all the other people who were there to make your book work, and immediately you think, I just had the story, but they did all the work. And it changes your perspective and the way you approach other people, and that can only be good. And if we had a little more of that, I think the world will be a lot better place.
Jessica, from your own line and so on, do you feel that actually there is a sign? I mean, we've had hopeful signs before, but I think it's probably inevitable. We look at what's happening with respect to the Russia-Ukraine situation now. You think these guys, both sides, need to read this book now?
Yeah, I think part of what he talked about, they talked about having such a serious topic as the Rwandan genocide, and how, you know, making both sides look at each other and kind of just be like, what are you doing? Like, using humor to kind of bring that out. Like, I think that part of the problem is that humans have not changed, I guess. Like, there's always going to be somebody who's trying to stir up trouble. And I feel like, you know, some people will always, unfortunately, ignore things that these men say in this book. I feel like there will always be people who will reject that idea and will want to still chase after anger. And I feel like it's important to acknowledge that, because I feel like people, at least I did, like, sometimes it's like I get upset because I'm like, how can people think this is okay to do? Like, how can people do this? Like, but I feel like it's important to acknowledge that most people are not like that, and most people don't want that, and to really pay attention and acknowledge the people who are like how the president in Ukraine, how he is making such an effort to be with his own people and how much bravery he's expressing and fortitude. And I feel like that's so important to remember, that there will always be people who are going to fight for good and not give in to the anger, and that war is older than written history itself. And I feel like if we just get upset that it still exists, I feel like that won't make a change. I feel like having compassion, especially I feel like people, at least I heard in the US, like people were getting upset at Russian immigrants, you know, who have no relation to what the Russian government is choosing to do. And I feel like that's in a situation where compassion is necessary, or people who are living in Russia and they have no want for this to happen, but people are still kind of, you know, saying that they deserve any suffering as well. And I feel like it's important to remember that people are still people, and they're not really represented by the choice of somebody choosing anger who affects them all. I feel like it's important, you know, because I don't think war is really going away. I think it's just changing, you know, I think it's evolving in a different way, but I think that conflict is always going to be there. And it's important to remember that joy can still exist in a world that's torn up by war. Like, it makes me think of in World War II, when, you know, the two sides, I think it was, they exchanged presents on Christmas. And that's such a, I don't know, like, it almost makes me want to cry, like, thinking about it, because it's like, in the midst of all this suffering, like, people were still able to find this little piece of joy. And I feel like that's really important.
It was the First World War and the 1914 period. But of course, the generals decided that was ridiculous. So they had to move all the troops on both sides to ensure that none of that nonsense continued for the foreseeable future. And again, I think that is something where you almost have an exasperation about the whole process. Jenny, we're recording this. It'll be published, obviously, on what is officially World Earth Day. We're sort of being positive for World Earth Day. So happy World Earth Day to you from that point of view. Somebody from our generation, Jenny, do you think that actually that the optimism that in a sense, and I get a really optimistic tone, not just from the Book of Joy, but also from the next generation, as manifested in this case by Jessica, do you think this is a good sign, it's a hopeful sign that actually, you know, we've got a lot of mistakes that we've made, we've got a lot of things that we need to acknowledge, but we are making progress?
I think we are. I think we're two steps forward, one step back. But we've still got two steps forward. There's at least one step of that keeps going forward. I think we have to trust another generation, and we have to be willing to hand it over and go, look, we're really sorry we made a bit of a mess of this, but maybe you can do better. And they have to forgive us for the mistakes that we've made, just as we forgave the people before us who made mistakes. I think that's how it will work. If we don't, I don't think it will work.
There are a large number of exercises, obviously, at the end of the piece that I think work quite nicely. I was tempted initially, because obviously I was just looking at it, when I saw Douglas Abrahams, I thought, oh, that's Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. No, of course, that's Douglas Adams, as opposed to Douglas Abrahams. But I'm sure Douglas Adams would have had something to say about this as well, really, in terms of the craziness of the whole system. Any takeaways from yourself, Jenny, in terms of things that this might have actually led to maybe sort of thinking, OK, when I'm doing Tipperary Tales, I'll need to just, you know, remember to breathe.
Well, yes. And also, I carried a bad habit with me from 2 years ago. Just before we moved, I was in such a state. I was sleeping really badly. I'd wake up at 3 a.m. and I could not stop myself thinking, worrying, fretting, crying. I rarely slept after 3 a.m. And I still occasionally wake up and I get, I suppose, that some form of panic attack. And I had one just after I'd read this book, and I thought of the breathing exercise that they talked about. So I lay there very quietly and started to do the breathing thing, and started to think about something I was doing that other people helped me with, whether I know them or not. And I fell asleep again. It was wonderful. It freed me from that. And since then, when that's happened, I've done the same thing. And that makes me smile. Maybe that's the beginning of joy.
the attitude of gratitude, to quote a strap line we used to use quite frequently. As we said with Rob, it would be crass to actually say, do you have a favourite character here? Because obviously they're both real life human beings, so we can't choose one as opposed to the other, otherwise we'll be throwing in, well, what about Pope Francis? Another sort of folk who is still around, etc. But still. But Jessica, what is your score out of 10 for The Book of Joy?
Oh, I'd give it a 10. I think sometimes with, help books, nonfiction books, sometimes they can get a little unhelpful to me. They can get a little caught up in itself. But this is not that. I think that this is up there with The Problem of Pain for me, from C.S. Lewis. Like, I think it's an excellent book that also talks a lot about suffering and joy and happiness. And I feel like both are very necessary and everyone should read them.
Except we wouldn't force anybody to read anything. It's a case of it has to be people's choice to actually work through that. When the student is ready, the teacher will arrive, and so on. Jenny, what about yourself?
I would give it a 10 as well. It is one of it. It doesn't read like a self-help book. It reads like a real narrative and something of great value. Mm.
And yes, I think I'll also keep the 10 score going. Robert, I think, went for a 9. But then again, he's having his own challenges with Middlesbrough Football Club at present. So that's understandable. You need to obviously just work through that. Sorry, Rob. But yes, I think a 10 for myself. Again, when I suggested this, I was a little bit uncertain because, as Jessica said, sometimes self-help books, they can be a little bit preachy. They can often leave you with a sense of, fine, okay, this looks as though it's a very good business plan for somebody to actually develop a whole range of wonderful systems here. But actually, there isn't a hidden agenda here. I think the agenda is quite simply look at the whole sort of humanistic aspect and an approach from that point of view. I did like the line when the Dalai Lama effectively said that maybe we need to ease away from religion. He said, don't worry, it'll be about 1,000 years before we can actually do without religion as a way of actually working through the process. So it works on that basis. So there we are, The Book of Joy, a resounding hit. And any thoughts about the next book of the month, Jenny?
I thought, since we're coming to the end of the football season, I'd go off the wall a bit and
that's
choose...
soccer, of course, for United States listeners. I'm just making it clear.
Absolutely, yes. Well, Jessica might like this one. Rather than soccer, I go a bit off the wall and choose a sports-related book by a great crime writer, Playing for Pizza, by John Grisham.
Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting, podbean.com. Probably the best download decision you'll ever make.